I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We are thrilled to record the 2016 Plantarama Symposiums. In this recording, you'll hear Claudia West, who has an extensive background in horticulture, ecology, and environmental restoration. She holds a master's degree of landscape architecture and regional planning from the Technical University of Munich, Germany. Claudia is currently ecological sales manager for North Creek Nurseries, Landenburg, Pennsylvania, and has also worked for landscape architects Wolfgang Ohm and Carol Oppenheimer, and for Sylvia Native Nursery. Without further ado, here's her presentation.
Hello and welcome. I can tell you what a pleasure it is to spend an afternoon with fellow plant nerds and plant geeks here in the audience. So thank you all so much for coming. Thank you, Plantarama, for inviting us. It's been nothing but a treat. So the next hour, I would like to geek out over plant combination with you guys and dive in a little bit deeper in some of the parts of the book that Thomas talked about just earlier today. And I'm really glad I'm here. Thank you all for your flexibility in rescheduling this event. There was absolutely no way I could have made it out of there earlier this week. You will notice our vehicles. This is my car right here. This is the road I normally take, covered under almost 5 feet of snow, snow drifts that collected the entire field behind my house. Bob just asked me to show you some of these images here and as an excuse for rescheduling. That's me trying to get to my car with a shovel in my hand on my skis. And I can tell you, it was an amazing sight to see this machine come down our road. Absolutely wonderful and quite welcome after being snowed in for 3 days. So I don't know, but we got hammered with 29 and a half inches. It's good for plants. They're underneath this beautiful blanket right now. The frost can't harm them. I feel good for them, but I'm kind of glad that they got me out of there because our equipment only got to about here. And we didn't even get to the really deep parts. So... But without any further ado, let's talk plants and look at some green color here, which we desperately need at this time of year. So stunning ecological plant combinations. And I'm going to pick up right there where Thomas left off earlier with the fact that we all live in a post-wild world. It becomes very obvious when we go to cities, you know, New York, Brooklyn, but it's also very obvious if you live in a rural area like where I live. And this kind of urbanization and industrialization of our planet on a huge scale has, of course, traumatic effects on the planet and also on us people who live on this planet. We see a huge increase in what we call modern civilization diseases. You all know allergies, stress, depression, diabetes, eating disorders, all of these things, and a lot of them are now more and more linked to the effects of our own actions on the planet and what we do to surround ourselves with these home or people-built landscapes. So a real problem. But the interesting thing is that the more we surround ourselves with concrete, yeah, with landscapes we build, the more we seem to need this. Because this used to be home. This is where our species came from. This is where we evolved in natural landscapes surrounded by the most beautiful color on earth, green. And that green still has a magical effect on us people. It makes our heart rate slow down. It makes us breathe deeper. It soothes our emotions. And it reconnects us with this beautiful thing of wilderness that even if we live in cities and have parks right nearby where we can enjoy green elements, it's still not quite the same as going out on a hike in a natural landscape and being completely immersed in these wild and independent ecosystems, hearing the birds, smelling the mosses, smelling the, you know, esoteric oils in pine trees and things like that. It's really, really important for, you know, our own well-being. And it's the foundation of all these species that share the planet with us. And a very exciting thing is, you know, being a planting designer or working with plants like you do, or maybe in your home gardens or your clients' gardens, is that we are going through an international revolution in figuring out how we can bring this essential green wild element back into our cities and back into our lives because we need it to be healthy. And there's a fantastic array of beautiful, beautiful projects that are popping up all over the world now that show us how this could happen in the future. One example here is the Lurie Garden in Chicago. Many of you have probably seen it, right on top of a parking garage, completely man-made. But when you walk through this, you watch over 130 different bird species. You're reconnected. It feels like you're out in a prairie with a slightly different landscape surrounding you. But what's really interesting is that we, as planting designers and ecologists, have learned a whole lot in the last couple of years that teaches us how to create nature. Maybe it's not as good as what we destroyed, but that's gone. But we now have tools available to all of us to bring at least parts of this back and do the best we can in our cities for our own self-preservation. And because, you know, we do control this planet, we have to be good stewards of the planet and support, you know, all these other life forms that live here as well. So these kinds of projects, seeing them pop up in Chicago, in New York, you probably have seen many other examples in your travels, maybe abroad as well, are really exciting. And I think what's even most amazing is that all of you in this room sitting here today, we all have the power to help build similar landscapes. We may not change the world, you know, one at a time, but we all can do just a little bit something in every single project that we take on to, you know, really advocate for a much larger change and, you know, make this whole beast of planting design move into the right, more ethical and more sustainable direction. And that's really exciting because, you know, we have seen how nature can come back even in really bad parts of town or in industrial areas. It's really encouraging that every time you write a planting plan, you specify plants, or you work in a garden, you can make a difference. So I love that about my job. It makes it feel very meaningful and rewarding at the end of a day. And I hope you all feel the same. And it's really a joy to see plants not only being beautiful, but to also see them support all the wildlife that we love so much. Very rewarding. And it creates a much, much deeper connection with a built landscape that goes way beyond color, you know, and beauty. That functional layer of plantings is really, really a powerful thing that, you know, I don't know how you feel, but I enjoy very, very much. When I see this Phlox paniculata, it's a cultivar called Gina, a very old cultivar covered in swallowtail butterflies. You know what? I love it. It's absolutely wonderful. It invites a whole other concept of gardening, why we garden, into my life, and I'm just absolutely floored. I love that beauty. So these ecological factors are extremely important because they're important to keep all these species that depend on plants alive. Yeah, these species are really essential in the foundation of our environment. You all know that, so I'm just repeating that real quick. So what's really interesting is that gardeners and designers have reacted to that, and we now know that what we put back doesn't just have to look beautiful. It has to be ecological functional. That means instead of just planting plants, we now plant salad bars for insects. We put as many asclepias out there in the landscape as we can, and we're not really angry anymore if the monarch butterflies, their caterpillars, devour them and eat them down all the way to the ground every year. It's a good feeling. We feel like we are giving something back as being stewards of this planet. So it's a wonderful thing to see all these habitat landscapes popping up in schoolyards or on larger restoration scale sites. Wonderful thing. And we're learning more and more about what specific species or what species versus what cultivars are really good at feeding wildlife. Now, in the past, a lot of this was, you know, highly emotional debate based on very little research and very little scientific information. But now, thanks to folks like Mount Cuba Center, Clemson University in Michigan, and other really great places, North Carolina University, where we're doing studies and checking out, well, how do cultivars of Echinacea, for example, or many, many other genera compare to the species in terms of wildlife value? really great information that's starting to become available to all of us planting designers to take some of that guesswork out of what species we should be using to, you know, create the most functional and beautiful planting we are capable of. And what I'm really excited about is the research at Mount Cuba Center, where they're not only looking at what cultivars versus species provide more nectar and pollen for bees and butterflies, but they're also analyzing, for example, the sugar content of that nectar to see, you know, how well do these plants actually feed these insects and where are the differences. So keep an eye out for that. I think in a year from now, probably maybe if we're lucky at the end of this year, we should see some really great research coming our way that can make our planting designs much more informed and hopefully help us, you know, create more ecologically functional planting on these small planting areas where we're working. Mount Cuba Center is also looking at a very different component of plant selection. Now, you all know when you look at the dandelion, the flower is completely yellow, right? We don't see any shades of yellow in there. It looks very much like one yellow big flower. However, insects see these flowers very differently. Most insects can see a large spectrum of ultraviolet light, and to them, this dandelion look extremely different to what our eyes can actually perceive. They see the whole plant world with completely different colors than we do. They can see secret landing strips and little bullseyes in the middle of flowers that help insects find the pollen and nectar sources in these plants. And wonderful thing is that Mount Cuba Center is also looking at how these different flowers, species versus cultivar, are actually seen by insects. Something that's totally invisible to us people. So again, we can make better decisions about what species support all the wildlife we want to attract into our gardens, the wildlife we want to support, what supports them the most. So stay tuned for that information. It's going to be coming out hopefully very soon. I think that's really important. The other thing that is really important when we're talking about ecological planting design is that it doesn't only matter what we people, you know, specify in our own gardens or for our clients. It now also matters very much where these plants come from and how they are grown. Because just choosing the right ecological species is not good enough anymore. Now, these plants actually have to be safe as well for people and for pollinators and all the other wildlife that may eat on them and nibble on these different plants. So a wonderful thing is that this discussion is now going mainstream. We've had some pretty massive scandals in the United States, but also in Europe, concerning some larger box stores where systemic pesticides were used in plant production and have caused these plants to actually stay toxic long after they were shipped to a customer or to a client. And that has caused, you know, monarch butterflies to drop dead as soon as they touch that flower. So I'm really glad to see research and regulation picking up speed there to help us grow safer plants, maybe reduce the amount of neonicotinoids our industry is using, and just being way more informed about how we can grow native and ecological plants on a larger scale using things like IPM technology, integrated pest management. We at North Creek Nurseries are doing a lot of work like this. We have an entomologist on staff who is very frequently releasing beneficial insects. It's only using things like soaps or vinegars to keep our plants healthy because, you know, with large-scale plant propagation, it becomes really difficult to keep plants healthy and safe. But it's important. So every time you purchase plants, maybe you want to find out, you know, how these plants are grown and see if you can, you know, shove your or push your plant supplier in the right direction. I think you guys have a lot of power over this because you all have wallets and you can decide where you purchase plants that are safe for your ecological projects. So really, really important. And if good planting design and safe plants line up, beautiful and amazing planting can happen. And that's really a joy to watch. And examples, as I said earlier, are becoming more and more frequent in our landscapes, which just makes me so happy. If I see a stormwater planting like this one, for example, at the city of Lancaster, where we have all these different layers of plants that Thomas described earlier, layering one on top of the other, soaking up all the stormwater runoff that flows into that. breaking down all the petroleum-based pollutants, absorbing all the heavy metals that wash in with the highly carcinogenic brake dust, soaking up all the salts. Yeah, if I see this happening, and then the whole thing is covered in insects, and it looks gorgeous, then I think, yeah, there's hope. We can really make a difference. So really exciting to see these projects happening. But the unfortunate thing is that these plantings are still very rare, yeah? I think the majority of the plantings that surround us are more of these traditional style plantings where we do plant, you know, little miscanthus like soldiers in a row in solitary confinement, surrounded by oceans of herbicide-treated mulch so no weed would dare ever come up, just letting plants, you know, develop their own habit without any competition from other plants. Wow. This kind of planting requires a lot of resources, and it does put a lot of really problematic substances like glyphosate out into our landscapes, because that's what's needed to keep something like this alive. The problem I have with this planting is that it simply doesn't put enough of the right plants back into our landscapes. Think about this massive change on the planet. Think about all these huge parking lots. Think about flying over the United States at night and seeing all these big cities lit up, like Thomas said earlier. Every chance we miss to put plants back is a lost opportunity to offset some of these huge developments on the planet here. So it really saddens me, and it almost makes me a bit angry, to be honest, if I see wasted space in planting where something could, you know, bloom its heart out, attract all these great pollinators, make our lives more livable, you know, give us joy, soak up more rain, clean that urban air a little bit more, and maybe mitigate some of the heat island effects as well. So it's really sad that, you know, this kind of ecological planting is still, you know, not the majority of what we're seeing there. Unfortunately, we're still surrounded a lot by these soldiers in a row, solitary confinement kind of planting, where a lot of mulch is filling up the spaces instead of plants. That's a huge concern. And that's not only the case here in the United States, that's unfortunately also the case in parts of Europe. So it's a problem because we don't have enough ground cover, not enough functional plants in that landscape. But we do have a lot of weeds, because with this kind of planting, you know, we leave a lot of different gaps open in the summertime, but also much more actually in the wintertime, where opportunistic species, you know, all these, you know, usual suspects here, come up in a heartbeat, because many of these weeds absolutely love the open soil that we leave behind in these more traditional plants. So our landscapes, these traditional landscapes, require a lot of maintenance simply because we just try to put our footprint on these plants, and we don't accept the fact that the best mulch on earth are other plants. Yeah? So the mulch industry is going to come after us at some point, I know that, but I think we're ready for that. So the alternative can be absolutely beautiful. The alternative of lush, dense planting that is not only beautiful, but also offers all that wildlife and this great life that comes into your life with these plants. It's absolutely wonderful. And many, many great planting designers like Wolfgang Oehme or Pete Audolf right here are inspired by these fantastic natural plant communities in ecosystems all over the world. I was really fortunate to spend a few days with Pete in the Netherlands at the end of last summer and to visit some of the sites that really inspire his creative passion, where he got some of the ideas that, you know, then formed into, you know, projects like the Highline or like the Lurie Garden. And one really beautiful moment was in one of the few national parks in the Netherlands. It's called the Hoge Veluwe. And it's a fantastic dune landscape with Molinia, native Molinia cerulea, and some dune grasses right here covering acres or square kilometers, whatever you like to use, of ground. We have heather right here growing in sand. But you can see these principles, you know, of plants covering soil, even in extreme conditions, and of plants mingling with one another in these fantastic landscapes here in the United States and over in Europe. And as Thomas said, these wild landscapes can teach us so much about good planting design. if I take a peek out my backyard and I look at my meadow there, this is nothing special. This is not even a very native meadow. This has a lot of cosmopolitan species in there, and yes, a lot of invasive plants, you know? And that's okay. It still is functioning. And a few things that we can learn from something like this are very, very powerful garden design and garden management tools. And I think the first principle that's probably most important is the fact that plants want to grow in communities and that they are social. They're completely happy ignoring the spacing recommendations you find on nursery plant tags in this little meadow there. You could find almost 100 different species growing on 1 square meter in this fantastically diverse natural plant community, natural meadow. Really, really interesting. And these plants are healthy. They are thriving. There's not a speck of rust on their mildew or any of these things that are so common in our gardens. These plants are absolutely happy. And to dive a little bit deeper into how this works and why they get away with that, I'd like to take a look at this illustration here showing the structure of a meadow plant community. Now, this could be any other kind of plant community. It could also be a woodland plant community, like some of the ephemeral meadows you might see in the spring in some of our floodplain areas under deciduous trees. The principles are very similar in many different kinds of plant communities all over the planet. But what you see here is that these plants occupy these different layers within these plant communities. We have this strong layer of ground-covering species right here at the base of this plant community. And then we have taller species poking out through them right here. Yeah, it's really interesting if you look at their morphological adaptations. They can tell you so much about why this works. Taller species, like for example this Joe Pieweed right here, usually don't have any foliage right there at its base. Otherwise, they would really compete with this ground layer for light. Instead, their leaves are way up higher in the morphology of this plant. Yeah, and this is why it has stronger stems, so it can poke up out of this ground-covering layer. So they share the resource of light in different layers, kind of like a lasagna or like a layered cake in this meadow plant community here. And the same thing is happening below ground as well. Yeah, these ground-covering species right here, which are usually highly aggressive rhizomatous grasses or self-sowing forbs, none of them are ever going to win a beauty contest, right? Some of them might. But they also have pretty shallow root systems attached to them. These root systems are generally maybe 2 or 3 feet deep. Yeah. And these taller species that grow right over top of these ground-covering plants, they generally have much, much deeper root systems. They can go down up to 15 feet or more if the soil is deep enough. If you hit bedrock or a structure in a city, it won't go that deep. But in deep peatmont soils, for example, or coastal or alluvial soils, these root systems are remarkably deep and in some cases go way deeper than tree roots ever do. Really interesting. Now, I wish nursery catalogs would include more than just plant height and flower color and maybe included some information about the depth or the nature of a plant's root system so that when we put plants together, we can make more informed decisions about who we should put together as neighbors so they don't directly compete in the same above and below ground horizons. Instead, if they share resources in different niches there, they become really good and stable companion plants and they get away with ignoring spacing recommendations. So forget the 1 or 2 foot on center spacing, not at all. These guys don't compete with one another because they're layered. So the solution to bringing more ecological and more functional planting design into our cities, as Thomas said earlier, is really taking the best out of both worlds. Taking the fact that plants are social, that soil in general is covered densely with plants, yeah, and combining that with the clear legibility, the patterns of color, of texture, of a traditional horticultural planting in what we call a designed plant community. Yeah, that has no mulch, but instead really dense, thick plant ground cover layers right here and functions more or less like a wild plant community. Now, this idea of designing plant communities and meeting nature halfway is by no means brand new at all, okay? This has been around for 60, 70, 80 years now. But what I find so exciting is that we finally have enough knowledge now and enough experience in doing that, that this kind of planting method has become a true alternative to traditional horticultural planting. It's now refined enough, and we've seen enough good examples of that in the world, that it becomes a tool that's available to all of us. And the book was an attempt to really collect the information that shows us how to do this in one, well, guide piece of work and communicate some of these principles. But some of the first people who, I would say, set the foundation for plant community-based design are my personal heroes, Richard Hansen, Friedrich Dahl, and Hermann Müssel, whom I had the pleasure to meet at the University of Munich, where I studied for many years, and we geeked out over plants a lot. But Richard Hansen, right here, he was a really good friend of Karl Förster. You guys might know the name, Kalamar Grustus. Karl Förster is named after this guy. He is like the father of perennials, one of the first who used perennials in planting design 1870s to just before the Second World War, and has really inspired many of his colleagues to work with plants, especially perennials, in their designs. Now, to understand where Hansen, Stahl, and Müssel are coming from, we have to take a little bit closer look at the time in history when they were working in Germany. And, they were working in Germany at the University of Munich right after the Second War, when pretty much a large part of the country was completely bombed out and destroyed. And folks were really focused on surviving, feeding themselves, staying alive, right? So any kind of gardening we did, my grandparents did, was related to producing food, vegetable gardening, on a very efficient, using permaculture kind of level to feed their families. And the country was being rebuilt at this time in the 50s and 60s with a new kind of urbanism that replaced all these old city structures. And, we tried to do this so well, we said, we'll stack people one on top of the other and be really efficient in this. But many of these architects rebuilding German society and our infrastructures forgot one important thing when they were building these cities again. You all know what I mean. Yeah, what did they forget? They forgot plants. Yeah, they forgot this one important thing that we all need so much to stay healthy psychologically. Yeah. Yeah, mentally, all that. So there were very few spaces left or designed for parks. Yeah, Hansen and Stahl knew that these parks, green, being in touch with nature after those traumatic events that people experienced in their lives at that time, were really essential for rebuilding a stable Germany, a culture that wouldn't derail again like it did a few years prior to that. But the problem was that at this time in history in Germany, resources for gardening were extremely scarce. People were still trying to feed each other, yeah? So traditional horticultural planting design with mulches and constant weeding was absolutely impossible, considering how little resources cities and townships had available to bring planting, ornamental planting, back into people's lives. So they were looking for solutions. How can you bring planting back without requiring these tremendous amounts of resources? Yeah? And their inspiration, just like what we're talking about today, was nature. They too saw that in natural plant communities, where nobody is mulching, nobody is using fertilizers or herbicides or doing anything or cutting things back, plants thrive. And they often thrive so much more than they do in gardens where we try oh so hard. Yeah. So Richard Hansen here, for example, in an alpine meadow in southern Germany in the Alps, studying wild plant communities and trying to understand which of these principles can planting designers use to make planting more stable and longer lasting, so they become true alternatives to bring nature back into a new German landscape. And one of the most important principles that he, for the first time, and his team formulated for the world is the fact that good planting design needs to build what we call a lebendige Bodendecke. That means living ground cover, huh, Sabine? We don't need everybody to learn German, but it translates to living ground cover. So that fact that in wild plant communities, plants mingle very densely with one another, and you see hardly any bare soil, was one of the principles that he and his fellow researchers there taught generations of landscape architects who went to that school after the war. And he set the foundation for plant community-based planting design. Really amazing. At this time, it was revolutionary and in a way groundbreaking. That garden here is the Sichtungsgarten in Weinstephan. If you ever have any opportunity to travel to Germany, just north of Munich, in Freising, this garden now is 60, 70 years old. And it's still extremely stable. Some of the bones that they designed in the 50s and 60s are still there. So if you don't believe that lebendige Bodendecke, living ground cover can be stable, go there and see for yourself. It's really impressive how much of this is still in existence now with very limited maintenance resources, even in a high-profile garden like that. But Hans Lindstahl and Hermann Müssel, of course, knew that in nature, not all plants cover soil equally well. Yeah, when you look at wild plant communities, plants play different roles. Just like, you know, when you have a soccer match or a football match, players play different roles there. Some plants, you know, you might only find one or two in a wild plant community, and others, like this little dahlia, you know, bigger sweeps, and then these, you know, ground covering sedges under here, you might have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of that same species in that plant community. So there are obviously very different plant behaviors out there, yeah? And being German, what did we try to do? Well, we tried to put things into categories. We're kind of famous for that. And that's exactly what they did. They said, wouldn't it be cool if we could actually classify plants by how they grow in wild plant communities? So that would help planting designers build better planting design inspired by how it already works in the wild. And that's exactly what they did. They called these things Geselligkeitsstufen, levels of sociability, levels of plant sociability. Who in the room is familiar with that? Interesting. See, I couldn't design a single planting without this fabulous tool. Hermann Müssel and Richard Hansen found that in the wild, plants occur in maybe five different categories. Category one are species that are found, you know, maybe just one or two plants at a time, kind of like that silphium we saw in that earlier slide. Category two, you find maybe 3 to 10 species of that plant, you know, in one little place in nature and wild plant communities. Category three, maybe 10 to 20. Four, slightly larger groups. And five are these really big expanses. These are species like Phragmites or cattails, who naturally make really large populations in the wild. You know, some of them are associated to water or brackish areas. Wetland species do this a lot, category five right there. So these behaviors here, or these groups, are entirely based on how a plant propagates itself in the wild. You know, if it's clonal, right, it spreads by rhizomes or stolons, it's probably a 4 or 5 category. If it's clump forming, think about baptisias, you know. They don't reseed a lot, but they stay there in that soil, probably get really old, very long-lived. So it tells you a whole lot about a plant's behavior and, you know, how they can be used in planting design. So the next thing they did after they developed this really fabulous design tool is that they sorted all the plants, species and cultivars, that were currently available in the European plant market, Central European plant market, into these five big categories. And they produced a very thick book with that. So I just want to show you a few examples of this here. And keep in mind that this it was published in 1981 and translated in 1993 into English. Some of these species are a little outdated, and some of them are species we maybe don't use as much here in the United States anymore because they've done a lot of damage here to our ecosystems, right? So, but, you know, just showing you what categories we have here will actually hopefully help you to sort your own plant palettes and what you use in your own designs into these five big categories to make more informed decisions about how to place plants together. Because very often we make very arbitrary decisions about how many of each we want to see in a planting, and we don't relate that enough with the actual behavior of a plant. So that's what they were trying to solve and give us a really great tool to do that. So without any further ado, level one, species that grow in singles or in small groups. Eupatoriums fall into this category. We have some Oryngium yuccifolium, our native rattlesnake master. Oruncus dioicus, the native one, also does that. Or things like Achnatarum calamagrostis grow, you know, in nature, in singles or in various small groups. Level 2 are plants that grow in slightly larger groups, maybe 3 to 10 of each. New England aster does that. Smooth aster, Adiantum pedatum, our northern maidenhair fern, does this in wild plant communities. And yes, Hemerocallis do that. Daylilies, in its natural habitat, not the invasive one here in the United States that covers entire stream banks, but in a natural habitat, they grow in really small groups. Think about how many planting designers use this plant. In, you know, especially commercial plantings, you see like thousands at a time covering entire, you know, entrances of to buildings or to shopping centers and malls. Well, the fact that this doesn't grow like this in nature tells us a lot about why some of these plantings require so much maintenance. Yeah, because a plant like this naturally doesn't want to cover that much space on its own. It's not morphologically designed to do that. Instead, it grows maybe with a matrix of grasses and pokes through that in little islands and little patches. Okay. Level 3 are plants that grow in much larger groups, like Eucoa longiflora, salvias do that, nepetas, lavenders. Many of them are very popular garden plants. Level 4, even larger colonies. Now we get to plants that are slightly more aggressive, more clonal. Coreopsis verticillata does that. Epimediums, Astilbe, Acerum, and Teneriums, of course, do that a lot in much bigger groups. And then last but not least, the 5th group, and this is a really dangerous group of garden plants. Probably had nightmares about things like Pachysandra, right? Or Vinca. Oh my gosh, how terrible. Lysimachia punctata is another really aggressive plant. But even Tiorella cordifolia, or native foam flower, can create really large masses in wild populations. So can sensitive fern, Onoclea sensibilis. If you ever seen that growing in, you know, somewhat shaded or sometimes even full sun, mesic to moist meadows, that's where this plant is at home, making these bigger groups. So Hansen and Stahl really, this is why the book is so thick, sorted all these plants, you know, the plant name, and then here, Geselligkeitsstufe, into these different levels. Some plants fall into more than one group. It's complicated, but it's really a powerful design tool. Why is that so important? Well, if we ignore that, and use, you know, say, Calamagrostis colforster, you know, a very popular plant here in the United States. It was actually found near Berlin, you know, a ground covering plant. It's a typical level 1 or level 2 species. It would only grow in very small patches in the wild, yeah? It never is designed to cover soil very densely. So if we use it like a ground cover, we shouldn't be surprised at all if there are so many spaces left in between where weeds can easily come up, yeah? So unless it's underplanted with another plant, it's really not a great ground cover. That's one example. Another example is that, do you guys know this guy? Yeah, Imperator Red Baron. Oh my gosh, it's a bad, bad plant. But obviously the designer here had absolutely no idea what this thing is capable of and used it as a level 1 plant, yeah, 1 or 2 at a time, turned around and came back a minute later, and guess what happened? It showed its true character. It's obviously a typical level 5 species, as aggressive as it gets. Clonal, super aggressive, and completely overwhelmed the planting and outcompeted other species very quickly. So these levels of sociability are really powerful design tools that can help prevent things like that and help us build more designed plant communities, because we're taking into account how the plant behaves based on how it propagates and how it interacts with other species. Really great what they did there. But now, in the next part of this presentation, I would like to connect these levels of sociability with the different layers of plant communities that Thomas introduced earlier today. So how does it work? Which of these plants fit into these different kinds of layers right here? Yeah, and there too, plant behavior is the foundation of good design. So let's look at structural plants as the first category. Yeah, these are plants that are really important in a planting. They're its backbone, and we don't really want them to move a lot in a planting, right? Because that can create a lot of maintenance. You know, we really like them to be in very strategic places, trees, shrubs, or taller perennials. And therefore, Hansen und Stahl's level 1 and 2 species, right? Remember the ones that grow either as singles or maybe as groups of 2 to 3 are really very suitable for these structural elements in design plant communities. They make a lot of sense. Yeah, they might be slightly clonal like this Eupatorium, but they would never take over a planting and create a huge mass of structural plants. So these level 1 and 2 plants are really great for that. Some natural examples of that are things like Asclepia syriaca, our native common milkweed right here. You can see it in this wild meadow. This is actually the cover of a landfill with cool season European grasses and this native monarch butterfly magnet just self-seeded in there and is providing beautiful structural aspects to this very, you know, thin-leaved grassy texture natural plant community. And that are really good examples of a structural plant in the wild. It's the Soliaca right here. This is at the coast of North Carolina, one of these coastal dune grasslands with Spartinas in there and all kinds of other, you know, really salt-tolerant species. It's really, you know, very obviously a structural plant that's holding that frame together, and it's the one thing you will also really enjoy in the wintertime. Yeah? In planting design, a few designers have really mastered working with structural plants, and Pete has really, really got it, you know, when it comes to that. He uses, you know, structural elements like this white cultivar of a Eupatorium fistulosum in this really fabulous park near Utrecht, and you know, helps frame this planting and connect it this, with this you know, structural element that was designed by the West 8 architects in this beautiful park. So structural plants really help make his plantings very legible and very clean. Plants that work really well for structural elements, and many of them are available in our nurseries, are things like the Eupatoriums. Yeah, we talked about that earlier. Many times either the species or maybe a slightly shorter cultivar that's a little bit more stable and won't flop over in your structural layer. Really great plants for that. Panicums and their cultivars work well for that. And you can just see how they are designed to be structural plants. Definitely category 1 or 2 coming into Geselligkeitsstufen or levels of sociability. They are not at all designed to cover soil. If we plant them as a solitary mass, you know, we kind of have to weed in here or put mulch down, otherwise other weeds will come up in between these taller structural plants. So North Wind is a favorite of mine to use as a structural plant, or even Rudbeckia maxima, just a simple species. What a pleasure this plant is. It's really dramatic right now in our rain gardens at the nursery. Its black seed heads poke through the 4 feet of snow, and it's a really great plant. It's a magnet for all kinds of bumblebees and pollinators, and just the color, that blue, which normally indicates drought tolerance. In this case, it's actually a little bit misleading. This plant actually does tolerate a lot more moisture than people think. Works extremely well in stormwater management systems and actually handles a few days of inundation during the spring and fall rain period very well. So I've really grown to love this structural plant in my designs. Fantastic plant. Or things like Schizocurium, standing ovation. This is one of our own finds, found at the nursery. How does it differ from the species? Well, when you look closely, the stems of this plant are about twice as thick as the species, which means if you plant that thing in more organic or richer garden soil, yeah, it still is strong enough to hold its own weight and doesn't fall over under its own weight. Many other cultivars with thinner stems only really work well if they're on very, very lean, dry, almost gravelly soils. This guy is different, and it really makes little blue stems now. It opens the doors to, you know, ornamental or residential garden design for this species. Really great plant, fantastic structural plant, and just, you know, eye candy right now in the wintertime with its beautiful seed heads and bronze fall and winter color. Really great plant. Another example of a structural plant is Phenonia glauca. This is very similar to the New York ironweed, but it's its more upland related little brother. Excuse me. It actually prefers slightly drier soil conditions than the New York ironweed. It's maybe a foot or so shorter, but again, a magnet for insects. I love using this in planting design. It's a really great structural plant. Winter and fall aspects are just incredible. Another great structural species is Laetra spicata. This guy, you know, doesn't get as tall, but it works as a structural plant for slightly shorter planting designs. So structural species doesn't always mean 10 foot tall. It can also mean maybe just 3 or 4 feet in height if your whole plant design plant community is much shorter. So if you plant a green roof, maybe it's only a foot tall, your structural plant. But in a tall meadow, it might be quite different. This guy, too, has incredible winter structure, and it has a fantastic root system. This guy can go down 15 feet in really deep soils. What I find so interesting about it is that 100% of that root system dies back every fall and winter. All that overwinters for Laetus spicata is a tiny little corm. It looks kind of like a bulb right there at the base of the plant. Think about this. It's pretty amazing. These roots grow back every spring, breaking up that soil, opening up infiltration channels for water. I love this plant. I use this a lot because it's just so beautiful and so functional. But yeah, I could geek out of this for hours. Aranchus dioica is another great structural plant if you are designing a plant community for shaded or woodland edge kind of settings. It too makes quite a statement there, definitely taller than most woodland species, and winter interest is there as well. So as we said earlier, when you use structural plants, it's really important to use plants that are fairly well behaved, unless you want to weed out all the time, because you want to make sure they don't turn into a wall. Yeah. So use them with caution. Like Thomas said, maybe 5-10%, kind of depends on your planting, not too many. Too many structural plants make planting really tall and often not very legible. They can create a real mess. So we use them with caution, and there's a reason why we use level 1 and 2 plants, because we want to make sure they stay in place and don't become too many. Yeah, that would overwhelm our planting. So maybe it will look like this. This is another a fabulous design done by Adam Woodruff, really brilliant designer. You can see some tall structural plants here. I think he was inspired by Pete Audolf there, some of the tall Eupatoriums. But you can see here, Silphiums and other plants are also, you know, poking up through, becoming structural plants later in the season. Art objects also work really well as structural elements. So you guys can have fun. Whatever tickles your interest, you can use that to create that first layer of a plant community. Now we would like to transition into the next layer. And that's, you know, as Thomas said, our seasonal theme plants. So what are seasonal themes? Well, seasonal themes are incredibly powerful. They are these big moments in nature where it feels like a painter spilled like a bucket of paint across the horizon. You know, a big field of Solidago, for example, or, you know, if you travel through France, it's a lavender field. Or if you travel through southern Germany, it's the red poppy is growing in the cornfields right there around Munich on those really alkaline soils. It's these big moments that connect us with the wild and really have emotional responses to us. I just, you know, when I stand there, it's really hard to show in a picture, but you can kind of feel what that feels like. You just want to wrap your arm around this planting and take that moment home with you, or take as many pictures as you can. Really powerful experiences in the wild that I know many of you have experienced on some of your hikes, maybe in natural plant communities, wherever your journeys took you. Big moments like this one here, Echinacea simulata again, that creates this incredible seasonal theme there that can either be color or texture or many, many different things. So if you want to create these themes, go bold. Don't just plant one or two. You need a lot of plants to create these moments in your planting at different times of year. And plants that work really well for that. We see some here used by Heiner Lutz. Thomas showed this picture earlier. This is the Ziegleibark in Hannover in Germany. Yeah, people absolutely fall in love with the way he uses the salvias and the bearded iris right there. Or here in a woodland setting, we have tiarellas and some trilliums, whatever species you can imagine, create these incredible seasonal themes. Remember, you know, when you go out there in the wild, you see Virginia bluebells all over the floodplain. That's a seasonal theme. And there's a reason why people go out and back to these landscapes every year, because it's really magical and powerful. So plants that really do this very well in planting design are actually quite available in our nursery catalogs. Now, industry supplies a lot of them. A lot of new
species and cultivars that fill that niche. Things like Stachys muniariae humilo work really, really well for that. They bloom a long time, they're just covered with flowers, and it's really easy to create these big moments in your planting design with species like that. This is one that Pete uses a lot. I'm sure you are familiar with that. Asclepias tuberosa is another one that does that really well. An insect magnet, not just the monarch butterflies, but also a lot of bumblebees that we see on there. And I just adore this plant. And think about what amazing moments you can create with this really rare color of orange if you use maybe 30, 40, 50% of that in your planting design. It's really special. I think your neighbors will love you if you dare try that. You create something that they would want in their own gardens. Aster Nova Anglia Purple Dome, for example, another great seasonal theme plant for fall. Use it in bigger groups right next to your structural plants. It's really traumatic. Or things like Amsonia Blue Eyes. It's a good one for early season. Actually creates a theme twice. It's fantastic when it blooms in late spring with this light blue color, but then the fall color, this orange golden fall color, can also create a very powerful seasonal theme in your planting. So as you can see, the opportunities, the choices are almost endless. Another one here, Retibida columnifera red midget. I've really grown to love this plant, especially suitable for hot, urban, dry hill strips with high pH soil, really good drainage, gravel, and abuse. This plant naturally grows in similar habitats in the southwest of the United States and therefore transitions extremely well into these man-made landscapes and could be another amazing tool to bring nature back into our cities and with them all the wildlife that so depends on them. So really huge fan, and anything that's red in flowers is a win anyway. So really great plant. Fanonia latimanii iron butterfly, another great seasonal theme plant. It doesn't bloom, maybe 3-4 weeks at the most, but the structure of this plant after the flower can be an amazing design tool if you're ever designing like an urban prairie or a schoolyard habitat or anything like that and want to play with these bigger masses of seasonal themes. This guy is very reliable and extremely long-lived. It will really be in that garden for maybe 30, 40, 50 years. Very, very reliable, adorable plant. And then the last seasonal theme plant, and it's one of my personal favorites, is Monarda bradburyana, Eastern Bee Balm. It's a tiny little short guy, like a little meatball, very glossy, deep foliage, and incredible flowers very early in the season. For us, it blooms about early to mid-May, so way earlier than most other Monardas flower, and that color is just really incredible. So when you use seasonal themes in planting design, don't just put a little Monarda bradburyana down there. It's not good enough. It needs to be much stronger and much broader to make an impact. So maybe it's something like this that creates a big moment. Here we have not the Monarda, but we have Pacora aurea, golden ragwort, that's used as a ground cover here that also provides a seasonal theme here at the Wolf Trap National Park for the Performing Arts in Virginia, Vienna, Virginia to be precise. And this stops people in their tracks when they walk through this meadow up here to the Feline Center to see performances or big shows. Even folks who have never been exposed to gardening still stop and take pictures. Because even though you may be an urbanite and not have any connection with plant, the seasonal themes still stir something in us and cause these emotional connections with planting and really make us just enjoy that color and these really great moments in nature. So very powerful. Another great example of working really well with seasonal themes we see right here, where we have Achillea and Zizia aurea right here as a seasonal theme in this planting with a ground cover of sedges underneath. A really great way of working with that. And now last but not least, let's talk about that last layer. Yeah, the one layer that's always replaced by mulch. Unacceptable. And that's the ground cover layer. And that's where Richard Hansen and Hermann Müssel's level 4 and 5 come in really handy, because we have a lot of ground to cover, so we need plants that are clonal, that propagate by stolons or rhizomes or reseed a lot on their own, because you don't want to be planting them on two-inch centers. You would like the plants to do more of that work for you. Yeah, so don't be afraid of using aggressive plants there. They're not going to take over your world, not at all, because all these other plants you already have there are perfectly capable of competing with them. Yeah? So in the wild, These ground covers exist in just about any ecosystem on Earth. Yeah, they exist in deep shade right here, this fantastic matrix of different sedges between and under the ferns and under the trees. They exist in full sun, really harsh sites just as much. Think about all the lichens. Think about all the Antenaria and some of these specialized grasses growing here right between these Anthropogon virginicus on that bald rock outcrop right there. So they don't only exist in woodland settings, but there are many, many ground-covering species that prefer full sun in really tough conditions. The only problem is that our nursery industry actually grows very little of these guys. Yeah, very often it's hard to find more of these ground-covering species for really tough sites, urban conditions, stormwater-related conditions. We have a pretty good array of species in the trade that, you know, cover soil under, you know, shade trees, but for full sun conditions, I think there's still a little bit of a gap in the market. So we're trying to fill that gap at North Creek with our R&D department, and you know, I think seed companies are a little bit further ahead there in what they offer. So many times we actually have to rely on seed mixes for ground covers, because some of these species are simply not available in the nursery trade. So often that's what happens, and they're being, you know, sowed underneath taller perennials to do that. So in a design setting, this last layer of ground covering species could be as simple as that. Yeah, it could be as simple as replacing mulch with green mulch, maybe with a very simple monoculture of ground covering species. Here we have Valsteinia fragarioides. It's now Geum fragarioides, been renamed again. This is all that in this formal landscape the maintenance team could handle. So whenever we can, we try to put in a more diverse plant mix. But sometimes you have to just be very realistic and know what your mow and blow guys can actually handle, what species they can differentiate. So sometimes we have to lose a little bit of the biodiversity there. But as long as plants are not replaced by mulch, you can't go wrong. Yeah. So this last layer is really, really important in planting design. And plants that work well for that, for example, for full sun, are things like Aster ericoides snowflurry. Great plant, works extremely well in extremely dry, rough soils, maybe high pH, another great urban plant. As soon as the soil is too moist for it, it sometimes gets this black fungus in the fall. So it really likes well-drained areas for its proper performance. Or things like the Champsia flexuosa, wavy hair grass. It's one of my personal favorites. It's, you know, fantastic for woodland or woodland edge plant communities on extremely dry sites. It does extremely well under a mature stand of pine trees on my property in northern Maryland. But there's also an ecotype of this species that does extremely well in coastal settings, yeah, on sandy soils with high salt levels in that soil. So there are many different choices that you can work with in this ground layer. The Champsia cespitosa, that's its little brother right here, is a fantastic native cool season grass. And this is what it looks like in the landscape right now. The core of this plant stays completely evergreen, and that's extremely helpful because we need ground cover not only in the summertime but also in the wintertime. That plant works really well for that, tufted hair grass. Or fun things like Solidago golden fleece, you know, another great plant that's been in the trade for many, many years and still, you know, going strong, very reliable ground cover for semi-shade. Full sun, another example, Sedum angelina. This was actually selected by a friend of mine in Austria. Interesting to see a European plant be so successful in the United States. But it tolerates our hot, dry conditions extremely well. It's used on green roofs a lot as a ground-covering species, but also works on really dry, regular garden soils with southern exposure or near concrete walls and curbs. Really great plant for that. List is endless. A couple more. Euchra longiflora. Just a species, not a cultivar, and I think just as amazing. Incredible fall color, leaves that just look like any of the new modern cultivars, but vigorous, healthy, lush, gorgeous, self-sowing, beautiful in the landscape as a ground cover. Last but not least, Pacora aurea. We saw that earlier, creating this seasonal theme at the Wolf Trap Center for the National Performing Arts. Another plant that is really aggressive. Yes, it's stoloniferous and rhizomatous, and it does reseed. But as a ground layer, that's exactly what we need. Yeah, because we want it to fill all the space densely with a desired species so that weeds don't even have a spot to grow up in between these plants. Yeah. So instead of letting plants be naked and not allowing anything to mingle with them and cover their feet, like you see right here in these Amazonias, we should try to fill in ground covers wherever we can. Yeah. Think about this. In your gardens, or maybe your clients' gardens, there's so many opportunities there to push more roots in the ground, to treat more water, to maybe offer more habitat and more food, more of a salad bar, more diverse salad bar for all those insects that depend on that. And I think our plants will be so much healthier because that's how they are evolved to grow based on where they come from in the wild. So you can really have fun with that concept and, you know, design whatever your heart desires with this principle of a design plant community, whatever expression you or your client likes. In full sun, orange shade, many, many different expressions of that are possible. And it's really a lot of fun trying to play with that and trying to watch plants interact with one another and sort it out. And a great example right here is these woodland phloxes creating this early seasonal theme in spring, mingling with some of the euchras and some of the Carex pennsylvanica that's under all of this, just emerging. And then these gorgeous structural ferns here. We have Lady Fern, Atherium felix femina, nothing special, but a really adapted native plant that is just gorgeous. I think, you know, really Europeans love that plant too. Really amazing. So this is what something like this would look like in a planting plan, just like what Thomas showed earlier. Instead of having individual bubbles of species, everything is kind of layered, like a layered cake or like a lasagna, with ground covers at the floor, seasonal theme plants over top of that, and then structural taller species as that next layer over top of that. And really dense, thick plant communities that have so much of that vigor and beauty of wild plant communities and can do such a better job at helping us bring nature back in our landscapes. So we've done a lot of really awesome projects lately where we're trying to put these principles into action and involve the communities, and you help us create these systems with dense planting and overseeding and putting, you know, wild plant communities back into cities where they are desperately needed. This is one example here in Baltimore with a school translating, you know, this urban health strip into a gorgeous meadow. And you know, people love it. They gravitate towards these little patches of wild in that landscape that's surrounded by concrete. It's really refreshing to see, you know, folks who never interacted with plants before at all, in their high heels, you know, going up to these plants and watching the bugs eating the milkweed right there and reconnecting with nature. These are beautiful, beautiful moments, and it just makes me smile when I see this happening in the landscape. So opportunities are everywhere. Be creative. Try it out in your next project. Anybody's garden, you know, any client's garden is a huge opportunity to maybe underplant a little bit here and there and use some of these principles to make your plantings more reliable, more functional, and more beautiful. And then I guarantee you, they will be more fun, and they will also attract more of these insects that will find you. So have fun with your projects. Thank you for your attention. Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.